This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to finance solutions that enable real growth.
Welcome to this BizNews briefing. It is Thursday, the 30th of January, and we have a full show with you today. We look at the plight of the SANDF soldiers in the DRC. Chris Steyn chats to Paul O'Sullivan as Duduzile Zuma faces terrorism charges. And we've got results out from the US, from Tesla, Microsoft, and from Meta. But before we go anywhere, let's go into our lead story. I caught up with Yaki Siliers from the Institute of Security Studies earlier today to get the latest on our troops, South African National Defence Force troops in the DRC.
The standoff between the president of the DRC, Tshisekedi, and Kagame. On the one side, President Kagame is the leader, came to power through force of arms after a genocide. But he is a Tutsi. They chased the majority Hutus out of the country. They fled into the eastern DRC. They established the FLDR, which is a Hutu-dominated organization that has been there for many, many years, and that presents Kagame and his government with an existential security problem. In the meanwhile, Rwanda has also developed significant economic interests in the eastern DRC. So the eastern DRC economy is inexorably linked to the Rwandese economy. And then you have in the DRC a government in Kinshasa that sits 1,700 kilometers away, has got little control and influence in the eastern DRC, and feels that the region is being occupied and influenced by Rwanda and dominated by Rwanda. We want to get them out. And there's been this. We must remember the history of this. Rwanda has repeatedly invaded the DRC for a variety of reasons. And there is a great degree of personal and other hostility between the president of the DRC and the president of Rwanda. So I don't think this is an easy challenge to resolve, and particularly if the rhetoric escalates as it has.
But Yaki, the fact remains that our SANDF troops are dying in the DRC, 13 deaths to date, and they are not adequately resourced. Is that a fair comment?
Well, the latest casualties happened as part of what the military would refer to as friendly fire. It was, in actual fact, a firefight between, as I understand it, the Congolese military and the M23, and the South Africans were caught in between. And it is true that the SANDF is not resourced. It cannot execute the mandate that has been given to it by SADC. I think about that, there's very little question. And we need to ask ourselves, we either have to resource the SANDF, and if we want to embark upon these missions, or we have to withdraw.
Oh, exactly. Because at this stage, if they're under-resourced, everybody agrees, it's tantamount to a suicide mission on the or from the perspective of the South African National Defence Force.
Yes, I must say, I agree. I don't think our military are capable of maintaining themselves in the Eastern DRC. They are like good soldiers doing that because that's what the government said they should do. But It's a mission too far.
Why are we not seeing that executive order to withdraw and really bring our troops home to safety when they do not have a hope in hell of accomplishing this mission in a successful manner?
Well, it's now become the issue has now escalated to national pride and we are at war and all kinds of stuff, which of course are unnecessary. We need to de-escalate, I think, the tension, because ultimately there is only a diplomatic resolution to this. South Africa is not going to go to war with Rwanda, and you know, we don't share a border. South Africa has been engaged in the DRC for decades and invested significant resources in trying to help and bring peace and stability to the DRC, given its size, its importance. But this problem between the DRC and Rwanda is an issue that requires a comprehensive response that includes the demilitarization, the cantonment, and everything else of the FLDR, and provision of security to Rwanda. Now, how you do that in the region that around Goma is extremely difficult to do. I don't think South Africa is capable of doing that.
If you were Minister of Defense of the South African National Defense Force, what would you do right now with regards to our troops?
I think South Africa needs to withdraw. But it's, you know, SADC is investing in trying to bring stability to the DRC. So it's not an easy challenge. From a purely military perspective, I don't think we cannot sustain both missions in the northern Mozambique and in the eastern DRC, not with the current military.
BizNews' Linda van Tilburg also writes for National Security News. She's been following the story and she's been receiving messages from soldiers on the ground.
The reports we're getting from the ground, on the ground, because since I've started covering the stories, people send me WhatsApp messages. And I've actually this morning had quite a disturbing one of women say they are women who are soldiers, female soldiers in the DRC, who are at the moment, they say, somewhere in a camp. They wasn't very clear. This was a message that was conveyed to her family, that these women are in the camp. They're held by these M23 rebels. And she actually said, we are scared of being raped. We don't know, you know, whether we could trust them. So the situation is quite dire on the ground. It's changing all the time. And as you've just said, you know, the message is quite clear. What is South Africa doing there? It's not our war.
And again, would you, I mean, I spoke to Yaki Siliers and we spoke about the fact that this is really a suicide mission with a lack of resources for South African National Defense Force members, and we should withdraw for the sake of our soldiers on the ground.
I can't agree more. And, you know, yesterday the minister, Angie Motshekga, was trying to say, but no general told her that, you know, on the ground told her that there's a problem. There's clearly a problem. They are severely under-resourced. I mean, analyst after analyst have said that. The former DA shadow defense minister, Kobus Maree, told me that it's literally madness for them to be there, so under-resourced. There's no way, if they get injured, apparently there's no way to evacuate them fast enough that they can save lives. Why Mr. Ramaphosa committed South Africa to this? And yesterday also Ronald Lamola, the Minister of International Cooperation, we call it just, you know, foreign minister in sort of old terms, but he also said, but we can't just withdraw, we're part of SADC. But you know, what Kobus Maree pointed out is that not even some of the countries around there are part of these missions. Why is South Africa there? It is geographically so far away from where we are. Why is this our war?
Activist capitalist Rob Hershoff's Malay-like speech has gone viral on BizNews' digital platforms. Here's an excerpt.
We don't even have a border anymore. Millions flood into our country unchecked, overwhelming our hospitals, our schools, our cities. And instead of enforcing immigration laws, the government celebrates it. Ubuntu, they say. Pan-Africanism. It's not Ubuntu, it's economic suicide. And when South Africans, black, white, colored, Indian, dare to complain that their jobs are being taken, that crime is spiraling, that services are collapsing under the weight, what does the government say? You're xenophobic. Crime isn't a problem in South Africa. No, crime is an industry. You're not being robbed, hijacked, or murdered. Are you even South African? The police? What police? Half of them are criminals. And even though a tiny minority are trying to do a good job, most of the other half are too busy taking bribes or sleeping in cars. And the ANC loves it, because it keeps people too scared, too desperate, and too dependent on their fake promises every election cycle. And while criminals roam free, law-abiding business owners trying to protect themselves with firearms treated like the problem. The government would rather disarm citizens than deal with the real threat themselves. Argentina is clawing its way out of the grave. Malay slashed government waste, embraced free markets, and told the socialists to shove it. South Africa could do the same, but we won't, because here's the truth. Our government, our ANC government, doesn't want the country to work. If South Africa was functional, the ANC couldn't steal any. If Transnet was fixed, they couldn't award another BEE contract to their cousin's shell company. If we had real leadership, the ANC would all be in jail. So let's be honest about our options. One, wait for the ANC to fix itself. Hilarious. Two, vote them out. Possible, but they've rigged the system and that'll take too long. We could leave. Many have left the country, but not all can afford to do so. Or build a parallel economy, private security, private electricity, private education, because the state has failed. State-proof ourselves. But here's a radical thought. What if we fought back? What if we stopped apologizing for demanding incompetence? And what if we rejected every single ounce of woke, socialist, corrupt nonsense spewed at us? What if we embraced meritocracy, capitalism, and the raw, unfiltered truth? Malay told the world to wake up. Will South Africa? Probably not, because let's face it, we're the Titanic, and the ANC is playing the violin while looting the lifeboats. But to those of you still awake, still fighting, still refusing to go down, the battle isn't over. And that, my friends, is the only reason I haven't packed my bags yet. I'm going to fight for South Africa, and I need you too as well. Long live freedom. Long live capitalism.
You can catch the full speech on biznews.com. In other news, Paul O'Sullivan says Duduzile Zuma wants South Africa to fail. BizNews' Chris Stain spoke to Paul O'Sullivan as Duduzile Zuma faces terrorism charges.
But in the eyes of this lady, I mean, I have no doubt that Duduzile Zuma Sambodla is a psychopath. And that comes through in her tweets. No matter what she does to conceal it, I have no doubt that she's a psychopath. And if she wants to sue me for calling her a psychopath, she's welcome to do so. But the reality of the situation is, in the mind of somebody like her, everybody that doesn't look like her is a racist. She's got a particular style about her. She can't even speak Zulu. She has to get people to do the speaking for her because she was brought up in an English-speaking environment. And English is her only language. And I'm wondering, well, hang on a minute. If you want to be more African than you are, why don't you at least learn to speak Zulu? Instead of criticizing everybody that doesn't look like you. I'm the way I look because this is the way God made me. I was born the way I was born. I grew up in the west of Ireland. I didn't see a black person until I was about 14 years of age. So we didn't have TV and stuff. I didn't even know what a black person looked like. I'd heard about it. We'd seen pictures in books. But I had no idea what a black person looked like. And I saw one and I wanted to touch to see was his skin the same as mine. So I certainly wasn't brought up in an apartheid family with apartheid feelings, and I have many friends who are black or white or Greek or Turkish or Indian. For somebody that doesn't even know me to call me a white racist, in her mind, everybody who's white is racist. But the reality is that if she projects herself like that, what she's absolutely doing is she's demonstrating that she is the one that's racist. And that's why she keeps talking about why white monopoly capital, and she wants to see the country fail. She wants to see this country fail. And if she's left to her own devices, the country would fail. And it, in my opinion, it's shocking. I feel aggrieved at the fact that I'm paying her salary. I just can't believe that this woman is taking R1 million or whatever it is an MP gets, R1 million or R1.5 million a year salary, which is paid for out of my taxes. I think it's an absolute disgrace. And that applies to a number of the people in the MK party. And it's no wonder that they seem to have lost the password to their bank account, because all the money they got from having all these representatives in provincial and national parliament, all that money seems to have vanished. I don't know what they're going to do for the rest of the year, because they still got to have people with salaries and whatnot. I don't know how they work. But to be frank with you, if somebody like her insults me, it makes me feel I'm doing my job properly.
Again, you can catch that full interview on biznews.tv. Now, Aaron Motsoaledi also had his chance to go viral after his participation at a panel discussion in Davos at the World Economic Forum. Motsoaledi says that the South African government is fighting a big war against those who are opposing National Health Insurance, or NHI.
In South Africa, more than any country, and I'm not exaggerating, our gross inequality is worse than in any country around the world when it comes to healthcare. Our Gini coefficient is the highest and it keeps on growing. And if you want to see that, it's more embedded in health. And so we are trying and battling to institute universal health coverage, which you call NHI. It's a big war. There are already 3 court cases to stop it by big business, right-wing organizations, even, unfortunately, doctors' groups who are saying we don't want this universal health coverage of yours, etc. The issue of universal health coverage, which many countries take for granted, is a big issue in South Africa. We are running 2 healthcare systems in my country. One is as good as you can find anywhere in Europe, and this is not an exaggeration. That's private healthcare for the well-to-do. Maybe when I use the word rich, it looks like I'm talking about millionaires, for the well-to-do. The second is like any other healthcare system on the African continent, not equipped in terms of human resources and everything else. And the problem is that in South Africa, we're already spending a lot on healthcare. We are on 8.5% of the GDP on health, which is very high. There are not many countries that are at that level. I know Europe average is 9. Now, the problem in South Africa is that the amount of money we spend on healthcare, not many countries can reach that, but the manner in which it's divided, talking about gross inequalities again, 51% of it goes to only 14% of the population, and the remaining 49% has to serve 86% of the population. I don't think any other country on the globe can be described in those terms. Unfortunately, that's where we are now. The only way to change that is universal health coverage, to come with equity in healthcare and divide this money in an equitable manner. We won't really need any extra money because, as I said, you never have enough money elsewhere. So our universal health coverage, which you call NHI, National Health Insurance, is going to be based on primary health care. In this regard, facilitator, we are already looking forward because we're scared. The world is now faced with an epidemiological switch from communicable to non-communicable disease. Well, countries in the north have already entered that long ago. Countries in the south are still in the middle. South Africa is in the middle. Many countries in the south are still at the level of communicable diseases. We are somewhere in the middle of South Africa, but about to switch over. And for that reason, we have already started preparations long ago.
In the world of business banking, the bottom line can often triumph over relationships. At Investec, we value both. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking, out of the ordinary.
At Sun Exchange, we make going solar simple, profitable, and completely risk-free. Join over 100 satisfied South African customers already enjoying the benefits of risk-free solar. Start saving today. Visit sunexchange.com and join the solar revolution.
A big day for results out of Wall Street. Tesla up first. Here are colleagues at Bloomberg.
Tesla earnings have just crossed, so let's get to that. Tesla saying that fourth quarter adjusted EPS was 73 cents. The consensus estimate was for 75 cents. And there's a headline here as well that there was less cost reduction than previously expected. Once again, fourth quarter EPS trailing the consensus estimates by 2 cents and less cost reduction than previously expected. Revenue, $25.71 billion. That is shy of the consensus estimate of $27.2 billion. And free cash flow, Caroline, $2.03 billion. Analysts were looking for $1.75 billion. But does this matter at the end of the day for the stock?
Well, does less cost reduction speak to a lack of efficiency that's going on from the man who's helming efficiency? I say that with a host of irony. But look, this
that
is
was my
a
first thought.
Well, I mean, there is an element here that this is a company that we knew was seeing difficult deliveries in the fourth quarter. It underwhelmed, and still the market went up and to the right in its share price. People don't care about ultimately the fundamentals, so we'll have to see how the market is reacting. We're dropping by 3% after the fourth quarter adjusted earnings per share did miss. They expect Cybertruck eligible for an IRA consumer lift there. So interesting that they're still talking about tax credits coming for certain of their cars when this is something that's clearly being talked about with the now Trump presidency. Achieved record deliveries in China, and China's going to be a key point, Romain.
And I just want to point out, too, gross margins coming in slightly below estimate, 16.3% versus 18.9%. And that operating income number, which we should put into perspective here, $1.58 billion. The street was looking for $2.68 billion. So a big miss on the bottom line. Carol.
Yeah, no, and another headline, the CyberCab scheduled volume production starting in 2026. Remember, earlier today on X, they talked a little bit about autonomous vehicles navigating from the factory to designated loading dock lanes without human involvement. They said one step closer to large-scale, unsupervised, full-scale driving or full FSD. And so there's a lot of things that are at play here that people want to know about, new products, new developments, you know, what continues to kind of move the revenue line and the revenue growth line.
Well, the folks who are bullish on Tesla think that full self-driving will be a key part of that. The company saying that this year will be seminal in Tesla's history as supervised full self-driving continues to rapidly improve with the aim of ultimately exceeding human levels of safety. It'll eventually unlock an unsupervised FSD option for our customers in the robo-taxi business, which we expect to begin launching later this year in parts of the U.S. The big question is, what do federal regulations look like around that? And where and when can Tesla actually do this?
All right, Tesla down about 5% here in the aftermarket. Microsoft also, it is down about 3.5%. Lam Research just out with some results, and it's up almost 5% in the aftermarket. So a lot of earnings coming here.
Bloomberg also bringing us the latest on Meta results, also out today.
Let's bring back Shweta Khajuria, Managing Director who covers global internet at Wolfe Research. And Shweta, it is unusual, as we've been saying, for Meta to wait this long to report earnings, but we did get first quarter revenue guidance where the midpoint of the range it offers trails the average analyst estimate, and it will no longer offer a full year revenue guidance. What does that tell you? That combined with the fact that the earnings came out a little bit late, what does this all add up to?
Well, I'm not sure what to make of the late earnings release. There could have been a technical glitch for all we know. But in terms of the numbers itself, for Q1 guidance, it came below the street estimates, but investors were expecting something around 40 to 42 billion, so modestly lower than what it actually seems, is my understanding. Expectations were lower than where the street was. And then also for the full year guide, they gave 114 to 119 million. And as I was just saying a few minutes ago, investors were bracing for up to 117 million or so at the high end in terms of the OPEX guide, even though the street's looking for about 111 million. So maybe modestly worse than what investors were looking for, not meaningfully. And I'm not surprised that the stock is down in the after hours because it has had such a run up over the past few days.
Well, there's no end to technology news today. Microsoft has also reported results. And of course, our Bloomberg colleagues have their finger on the pulse.
Now, Rishi, what was your main takeaway from this earnings release out of Microsoft?
Yeah, again, thanks so much for having me. Look, my biggest takeaway out of this is Microsoft kind of continues to execute in line with expectations. We can go through all the numbers and say, okay, well, Azure was maybe a couple, you know, maybe 50 basis points. light of expectations. CapEx was maybe a little bit higher. EPS obviously beat. Overall, though, I would say numbers were very in line with what we expected, where I think the market is pricing things in. As always with Microsoft, I think it comes down to the actual guidance that we get from Satya and Amy on the call, right? I mean, they pointed to strong bookings with OpenAI. The commercial RPO number was really solid. And so the question becomes, can they reiterate that Azure back half acceleration that they've been talking about as more first party capacity comes online? And I think as long as they do that, the stock can be fine coming out of the earnings report.
Yeah, we'd be remiss in not pointing out we're still talking about, at least on the Azure side, you know, basically a 30% growth rate here for a company that mature and at that size. That is phenomenal. But Rishi, the big question is, when do we get to the point, or when should investors, if at all, get to the point where they should start to worry about, I guess, kind of tapping out? I mean, have they sort of reached what they can reach, or is there more of a market out there for them to take?
Yeah, I think there's such a huge market opportunity there. Even let's put AI aside for a second. Even if we just think about overall cloud penetration, we're still in probably early middle innings when it comes to that. There's a lot of on-premise that needs to migrate to the cloud. As you get companies migrating to the cloud, adopting adjacent services like Microsoft Fabric, Cosmos DB, Azure, Synapse. And I think that drives the overall cloud growth number up as well. And then you layer on AI into this, you know, and if we're in early middle innings when it comes to the cloud, we're in maybe the top of the first inning in baseball terms when it comes to AI. I know we've been talking about this for so long, but as this technology continues to evolve, as the cost curve comes down, and most importantly, as new use cases come about, I think Microsoft is well positioned to capture this. I think they're in a league of their own mm-hmm. when it comes to AI, at least when it comes to software.
Former Didata executives have been granted leave to appeal against the judgment by Judge Denise Fisher, which invalidated the sale of the Didata campus by NTT. The Didata executives are confident that the orders made by Judge Fisher will be set aside on appeal. And in additional news, Rothschild & Co. has given its seal of approval on the 20 billion rand management buyout bid by Dominic Sewela, the CEO of Barlow World, and his Saudi partners. Sewela and his partners are now a step closer to ownership of one of the biggest brands in corporate South Africa. Sewela and Asali Partners have offered 122 Rand, or 123 Rand rather, per share. Rothschild & Co. came in at a valuation of between 105 Rand and just over 119 Rand, and that is well below the valuation or the offer that Dominic Sewela and his partners have put on the table, and is sure to give the board impetus to get backing behind the management buyout. That's it for your BizNews briefing. We are back on Monday with more on the local and global front. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to transactional banking with simple, transparent fees.